Hi, this is Rabbi Josh Yoder. I need to give a bit of an introduction for this edition of Who's Who in the Talmud on Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi by way of good news and bad news. The good news is that I had a special guest this week. My father, who was in town for a rabbinic conference, came by and for the shiur, and as you're going to hear, came an active participant, adding some very, I think, enjoyable, if not unique, commentary. The downside is that because I had given a presentation earlier today at the RCA conference on Masorah 2.0, which is also up on my website, joshyoder.com, the batteries of my voice recorder died in the middle of the class. So, unfortunately, it gets cut off somewhere in the middle of an interesting discussion. Not sure exactly where, but, them's the breaks. Serves me right, I guess, for not being better prepared, but still think it was an interesting enough shiur to upload, and would definitely recommend checking out the full source sheet on joshyoder.com in the post that's attached with this audio file. Thanks for listening, and have a great day. Okay, good evening. It is Tuesday, May, what is it, 17th?
Yes.
All right, thank you. May 17th, 7th Street Shul. Who's Who in the Talmud doing Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi? Very special guest today. My father, Rabbi Yoder the first, is here, which is good, because since this isn't halacha shiur, I'm not going to get into too much trouble.
There's trouble anyway.
Well, yes, but not like chiv misa trouble. Or at least I don't think so. I guess depending on who you are. So first off, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. First, a couple of quick facts. He's a fifth generation Tana. Lived 135 CE to either 188 or 219. The oldest son of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, which makes him the seventh generation from Hillel HaZaken. He's also called Rabbeinu HaKadosh, or just Rabbi, and it's attributed to having compiled the Mishnah. And I say attributed because that's kind of what the tradition is. Rabbi Yehuda wrote the Mishnah. There's no real sense of authorship that we have for it. And with this, I tend to rely on the writings of Professor Saul Lieberman in his book, I guess I have a double book, A Greek and Jewish Palestine, Hellenism and Jewish Palestine, where the way he describes the compilation of the Mishnah wasn't so much that he wrote everything down as much as he took all the formula of rabbinic statements and condense them into short statements that were easier to memorize. I'll see that a little bit later in terms of greater discussion about having compiled the Mishnah. But generally, the assumption is, if you ask like average Jew on the street who had some yeshiva education, is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi wrote the Mishnah. So first, let's do some stuff with the light. Typically, as we do it, anyone who wants to pass, they can pass. Oh, weird. Okay, sorry. Thought I was missing some stuff. All right, nope. All good. Just forgot to disable it. So, Prime, take source number one. Gemara in Kedushin 72b.
When Rabbi Akiva died, Rabbi was born. When Rabbi died, Yehuda was born. When Rabbi Yehuda died, Rabba was born. When Rabba died, Rabbi Ashi was born.
By Rabba, it should be Rabba. I normally make these corrections when... Yeah, all of these, again, are the Sincino translation because I copy and paste. When they translate Rabba, they do it R-A-B-A. Regarding Rabba, they do R-A-B-B-A-H. So it really means Rabba.
When Rabba died, Rabbi Ashi was born. This teaches that a righteous man does not depart from the world until another righteous man like himself is created. As was said, the sun riseth and the sun goeth down.
So this gives us, on one hand, a little bit of a historical context of, he didn't live at the same time of Rabbi Akiva. Right. I notice it says Rebbe, and it says, Kishamit Rebbe, Nolad Rebbe Yehuda. Right? Now, even though we're still talking about a Rebbe Yehuda, as in Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, the term Rebbe alone refers specifically to Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi. Right? Which is an addition, I guess a superlative honorific for him. Okay? So this is a fairly, late source, late Gemara, given that, it goes all the way through Rav Ashi, fifth generation Amora, fifth to sixth generation Amora. So you're talking about a fairly late, late passage here. But, you know, if you want to do with it historically, put them in a certain historical context. And if you don't look at it historically, you can also see, well, he would have at least been considered on the same level, or at least of competence or authority, as Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yehuda, Rava, and Ravashi, which is a fairly big statement. So even if you don't take it as a historical statement, it certainly shows at least that you're equating Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi with everyone else here. Yeah, want to take the next one? This is Gemara Sanhedrin 32b. You're free to do the Hebrew and just translate it.
Teno Rabbanan, Tzadik, Tzedek, Tzedek Yadol. A rabbi said collectively in a braita. You have to understand, Tanan means we learn in the Mishnah. Tano Rabbanan means all the rabbis are teaching. And Tanya means it's taught. And there are three different grades. This is not an original Mishnah, but it is a braita that was universally accepted. That's when it says Tano Rabbanan. And our rabbis taught collective, you shall pursue justice. Tzedek, tzedek, shirdo. Halach achar hachachamim le'yeshiva. Go after the sages into the yeshiva, where they're sitting upon him. Achar Rabbi Eliezer Lelod, you go to Eliezer ben Horkinus to Lod, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Levor Hail, Achar Rabbi Yoshua, Lepikiin, or Bikiin, that's in the north in Eretz Yisrael, Achar Rabban Gamliel, or Gamaliel, Liavnet to Yavnet, you know, you go where they set up shop.
Right, so you can even skip all the way down, and the money quote here is with Rebbe, Acha Rebbe Levet She'arim, Nachar Chachamim L'Shechad Gazit, so in the sages of the Chamber of Hewn Stones. Reason why he simply put this here is just, and why he underlined it in the English, is Rabbi Tu Beit She'arim. That's where he was primarily located. Gemara Ketuvot 103a gives us additional information into his life. Reading the English here based on Sensino, was taught Rebbe was lying on a sickbed at Tziporis, or Tzipori, but a burial place was reserved for him in Beth She'arim. Was it not taught, however, taught justice thou shalt follow? Follow Rebbe to Beit She'arim. Rabbi was indeed living in Beit She'arim, but when he fell ill, he was brought to Tzipori because it was situated on higher ground and its air was salubrious. Again, following the translation, which, you know, for those who are keeping score in terms of, you know, academic Talmud, the Gemara in Sanhedrin 32b probably then predated this Gemara in Ketubot 103a because it's clearly done in response to it, or at least they were aware of it. But yeah, so what this shows is at least he was based out of this place, Beit She'arim, and then when he got sick, he moved to Tzipori. That's it. Alrighty. So now...
What do we learn from this?
What? What you learn from this is that he was initially in Beit She'arim and then moved, trying to get some, you know, historical details about his life based on the Gemara. All right? Take source number four. This is the Gemara in Chagiga 2177c.
The daughters of Elisha ben...
Avuya. Otherwise known as Acher.
The English is much harder to read sometimes.
Yeah.
Went to...
Well, it says Halachu ben Otav in Yerushalmi because it's part of a sugya, so it really means his daughters went. But so I had to put in Elisha ben Avuya so you know what the pronoun is.
I was looking, okay. Went to Rebbe to collect tzedakah. He decreed, saying, do not show kindness or favor to his orphans. They said to him, Rebbe, do not look at his actions, look at his Torah. In that room moment, Rebbe cried and decreed to support them.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that?
So Elisha was kind of a...
Well, Elisha ben Avuya was Acher. He's the guy that turned into the heretic.
Right.
We covered him in the week with Reb Meir. But the question then was, what do you do with, you know, his kids? So initially, he wanted to take a hard line, which is he invalidated, you know, it's great he invalidated himself, but he also invalidated his entire family. And then they said, but... You know, what about? It's kind of interesting because the exchange here has nothing to do with his kids. It's more of a look at him for better. It's like, forget about his actions, look at his Torah. And then he actually changed his mind. Right? Al tabet b'ma'asav habit b'torato, which is a really interesting statement to make. It doesn't really matter what he did because he still taught
an illusion
a great deal of Torah.
Two illusions.
Yeah.
First of all, you are going to still give your bar mitzvah. Remember?
You'll have to narrow down all of Masechet Chagiga for me.
Okay, because that's where it's from. Okay. This was his bar mitzvah shir. Rabbi Meir, what taught him his Torah? In other words, this is because of the touch of Rabbi Meir. In other words, what's really important here? Is this a personal score you want to settle? You want to do the right thing? If it was the right thing for Rabbi Meir, why is it not the right thing for you? So this was Rabbi Meir's thing. Torah Torah, we put those Zara. I take the kernel, I chuck the chaff.
Hmm. And it also shows on a practical level that Rabbi Yehuda was open to having his mind changed. Meaning he made a decision. People said, wait, but like, isn't there another way of looking at it? And according to this narrative, he in fact changed his mind.
I don't think Rabbi's looking very good here. We had the same thing on the RCA.
Easy. I'll just make sure it doesn't... RCA stuff is...
Yeah.
Well, no, just keep RCA politics, internal politics. This is going on the internet.
This is going on the internet. It was reported that Rabbi Soloveitchik embarrassed a student in Shir and then later apologized. So, well, guys, look how great it was, he apologized. So I asked the idiot question. We shouldn't have been rude in the first place. He's a student. Why? If he made a mistake, you maybe put him out for it. It turned out the student was right. So why you shoot your mouth off? Say, maybe he's right. Let's think about it. So sometimes Gedolei Torah do things that are not worthy of the Gedolei Torah. Last night I had learned about Zerachya Levi, who died because the Rosh wouldn't let him in the town because you dare disagree with him.
Hmm. Okay then. Let's actually skip section 3 for a moment. Let's go on to section 4, where I wanted to include the things about writing the Mishnah. If you please take the Gemara in Gittin 60b, which is where it actually, we find the quote unquote Yisur for it. Verse number 6. You want to read the Hebrew?
Sarach Rabbi Yehuda Bar Nachmani, Metargamei Darav Shimon Bar Lakish, Ketiv. Ketov Lecha Et HaDevarim Ha'ele, Uchtiv. Ki Alpi HaDevarim Ha'ele, Hakisad. Okay, how can you have two different things that we're talking about here? One verse says, write these words down, and then it says, according to these words, are they written down or not? Hakesad. Hakesad is an interpretive addition. That means, how's it working? The word Hakesad is which side? The side that was originally pronounced like the S, garçon of French. Garçon, sad. The word sad. And he sad is sign. I mean, it's the same word. How can I resolve it? Dalarim shebichtav, those things which were transmitted to us in writing to be written. Yet karashai, you have no license, the omaram, to recite them al peh orally. Contra, devarim sheba al peh. If those are words were transmitted to you orally as an oral document, you can't say them in writing.
All right, so we're going to stop there. We don't have to do the rest of the source there. All right, you want to do the Rambam from the intro to Mishnah Torah?
Lama Asar Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Remember, one of the names of this guy was Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Kach lo hiniach hadavar kamo chaya. He didn't leave it as it was. L'fi sh'ra'a sh'atamidim mit ma'atim. He saw the number of students were decreasing, and they go away. The problems are recurring and recurring. The empire of Rome is spreading out in the world and is conquering. Israel mit galgalin v'alachin l'ktzavot, and the Israelite nation is rolled out into exile and going to the extremes of the earth. Chiber, chibur echad. Rabbeinu HaKadosh made one document. Now, chibur doesn't mean compositionally modern Hebrew. The word chibur is a self-standing document, as opposed to a perush. Perush and chibur. Chibur is a document like the Chumash, like the Mishnah, stands on its own. Whereas Rashi's commentary doesn't make much sense. You don't have the material on which he's coming. So he wrote a chibur that would summarize the oral Torah. But he wrote it as an oral document, not a document that you're going to read as a Torah-itic canon. Got it?
Mm-hmm. So he left a lot of stuff out?
What?
So you're saying he left a lot of stuff out?
It wasn't designed to be a law code originally. There's a book on this called The Iron Pillar by Dov Zlotnik.
This was written, according to Rav Shrira Gaon, as a compendium for conversation. The Gemara took it as a code, but you can tell from its internal literary structure, it's designed to be a compendium for conversation. If it were really a code, you would have only one point of view, and this is a halacha. And Rabbeinu HaKadosh wouldn't paskin against himself, it was the minority opinion. It was a Gemara as a conversation piece. This was a takeoff for a conversation piece. Okay. It was like a child's book. How can I send Torah Shabbat to the people? Remember, this was written 130 years after Churban HaBayit. The Jewish people will be unified by their Torah Shabbat Peh that the Romans couldn't get their hand on. So this is a way to concretize the constitution of the Jewish people.
The way that Saul Lieberman explained the development was, and notice he says Chibur in terms of Ketiva. The way he, Professor Lieberman explains it, he, and in this compendium, arranged all of these statements by different people in a way that would be easy to memorize. And he said that what was most likely was there was one physical copy that was stored in a central location for reference, but it wasn't a published book as much as a way for people to relay the information. And in fact, you've got quite a few Gemaras that say the Mishnah has it wrong, or rather, this is how the Mishnah ought to read, because there are a whole bunch of issues like of technical matter which, for the sake of memorization or dissemination, you had to make some editorial compromises. And sometimes it actually says, you know, flip these two words around. Or it wasn't this person, it was that person. And in the Gemara you have this commentary like, yes, this is the text that we have of the Mishnah, but it might be inconsistent with one thing or another. Or this might be the way that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi might have compiled it together, but we have these other traditions that might come into conflict with it. So even though the Gemara says explicitly the things that are oral should not be written down, that wasn't necessarily what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did either. And again, the Rambam uses the term chibur as much as kotev. Yeah.
Just a question about the, how things folded out historically, because so the Mishnah is obviously it's not written down, it's just an oral tradition, and then he writes it down. But when he writes it down, the Mishnayos already have conversations from rabbis in them.
Right, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi would record the statements of Tanaim that came before him that he got from an oral transmission.
So the Mishnayos, even in their oral form, included statements by various Tanaim. Even when they're in the oral form.
Correct. There are no Amoraim in the Mishnah.
Well, but I thought maybe not. There wasn't any Tanoim. It was just simply the word from Sinai.
Nah. So I mean, for that, if you like, go on Perkei Avot. Like the whole first chapter has that chain of tradition that does go back to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai, but you have included in there Shmaya Naftalion, pairs that came long before. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was even born, right, that are still recorded there. And the way that Rambam describes it at greater length is that there was an oral tradition, but as people, which was easier to disseminate, well, not really, you didn't really need to disseminate it when you had a central location. Everyone went to the same place, you learned from pretty much the same teachers, and it was a lot easier to get that information across. But at least following the Rambam's description of the history, which I will freely acknowledge might not be historically accurate per se, as his own chain of tradition, where he goes from David HaMelech to Shamgar Ben Anat? Thank you. I was going to get there eventually. Okay, Shiloni, who lived in the time of Yehoshua, means he wasn't trying to write a historical document because you didn't go from David HaMelech to some... The point is, he's trying to retell some form of a history here, but according to this view, as you have more dissemination, you can't teach such a mass amount of information orally and have it kept the same way.
The question that you say takes history in the Greek sense of the mimesis of copying nature. Achia Shiloni was the blind prophet. He is the Jewish Tiresias of the Odyssey. You heard of Tiresias?
Yeah.
He's like a... So we're dealing with literary motifs here. And the Mishnah being written in a literary document has literary qualities that the reader can easily identify. Mm-hmm. And in the time of the Amoraim, in the Babylon, in the Babylonian Talmud is a reciter of an oral text. The written text is not what's binding. What's binding is the fixed version of the oral text. And that's a Greek idea, because the Greeks believed in memorization, not in writing.
What you're saying, even though the Mishnah was already written down, the Gemara wasn't using that written down version when they were debating, they were going off
of it. You can't recite it. This is a reciter, the Tanakh, who's a bar there. The written document is not, it's written down, doesn't have the halakhic status of a written document that has been canonized.
Interesting.
The oral document has been canonized. When you do a ketubah, it says Na'um. You're signing your name that you witnessed it, but the word Na'um is to say orally, not to be written down.
Right, so they didn't necessarily acknowledge the Amoraim when they were arguing about it. They didn't necessarily acknowledge the.
There's no evidence for it. It's an oral document.
Okay.
All right, so let's go back to source number five here, in section number three. I thought this would just be an interesting study in terms of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's life, in that you have a Gemara in Avodah Zarah 10a to 10b that lists a bunch of exchanges he has with his fellow Antoninus. So one, Antoninus once said to Rabbi, I only put in the English here because it's fairly extensive, but please feel free to check out the original in Gemara Avodah Zarah 10a/b. It is my desire that my son Aversus should reign instead of me, and that Tiberias should be declared a colony. Were I to ask one of these things, it would be granted, while both would not be granted. Rabbi thereupon brought a man, and having made him ride on the shoulders of another, handed him a dove, bidding the one who carried him in order carry him to order the one on his shoulders to liberate it. The emperor perceived this to mean that he was advised to ask of the Senate to appoint his son to Aversus to reign in his stead, and that subsequently he might get Aversus to make Tiberias a free colony. So, when you have sources like this, it's... We've said this before, in terms of taking the Gemara as a historical document, it's maybe not. It can be a bit, it depends on the particular situation. You would sometimes need corroborating data. But here at least you have, enough cases here that seem to indicate that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did have regular correspondence with Antoninus, and it does, I think, explain a little bit either of his logic or his relationship with him. So here, for example, instead of giving him a straight answer, right, he teaches by analogy and has the other guy figure it out. So logically, if you only have one thing to ask, you ask for, the son to be in charge, and maybe, you can influence the son and he'll do what you want. It's almost like asking a genie for more wishes. Like cheating, getting around that. Next, on another occasion, Antoninus mentioned to him that some prominent Romans were annoying him. Rabbi thereupon took him into the garden, and in his presence picked some radishes one at a time. Said the emperor to himself, his advice to me is, do away with them one at a time, do not attack them all at once. But why did he not speak explicitly? He thought his words might reach the ears of those prominent Romans who would persecute him. Why did he then not say in a whisper? Because it is written, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice. Balkanafan yagid davar, pasuka, towards the end of Kohelet. So there was a certain degree of savvy he had there too. Pretty much any fictionalized, I shouldn't say any fictionalized, the good fictionalized accounts of the Roman government talk about a great deal of not just corruption, but politicking, and people worrying about, conniving in the back. Rabbi Yehuda, at least had, in the area of politics, had enough good sense to not say things explicitly, because if someone heard of something, he could have gotten killed. Or it would have undid all the plans. You want to do the next one?
Sure. Do you think? I mean, that's just...
Oh, sure. We can do more on this. Yeah.
I was just going to... Well...
Yeah, what you got?
I mean, if there's any sort of symbolism here, I've just the fact that he was... We were just because we were only just talking about things being written down should not be spoken and vice versa, what the symbolism is of him refusing to put these ideas into words and instead keep them as actions.
It's an interesting idea. There are enough statements that are made explicitly in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. This wasn't the way he always lived.
Yeah.
You do find every now and again people who do act things out. It's an interesting point. I honestly didn't think of it because I don't think this methodology is exclusive to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and it's certainly not the only way he communicated. You have people who do act in Mashalim all the time. It's an interesting point.
Yeah, it's just fun. Okay, do you want me to continue on five?
Sure. Yeah. Rabbi Yehuda, the emperor had a daughter named Gila.
The emperor had a daughter named Gila who committed a sin, so he sent to Rabbi a rocket herb. rocket, okay.
I'm following the translation of the Sincino.
And Rabbi in return sent them coriander. The emperor then sent some leeks, and he sent lettuce in return. Many a time, Antoninus sent Rabbi gold dust in a leather bag filled with wheat at the top, saying to his servants, carry the wheat to a rabbi. Rabbi sent word to say, I need it not, I have quite enough of my own. And Antoninus answered, leave it then to those who will come after thee, that they might give it to those who will come after me, for that I send them, and those who will follow them will hand it over to them.
Yeah. Probably a great deal of symbolism here, too, which can be read in any number of ways. And, you know, a whole bunch of ways to pick up. Anything coming to mind in particular?
Oh, they just remind me of that joke about when there's, I don't remember what the, it's like in Poland or something, the rabbi debating the Tsar without using words. You know that joke?
No, what's the joke?
No, gosh, I can't remember. Something silly, like they're debating without words, using only hand symbols or something. Like the Tsar challenges him and says, if you can defeat me in this debate, then the Jews don't have to leave. And so first, you know, like the Tsar does something like this, and then the rabbi does something like this, and afterwards they ask all the symbolism, and the Tsar says something like, you know, I told him that there's multiple gods, and he symbolized that there's only one god, and they asked the rabbi or something, and he said, oh, I was hungry, so I was asking for a sandwich, or something. So I don't know. You never heard that joke?
It's coming back to me. But anyway, take the next
two
paragraph.
Two readers in one room, and neither of them has heard that joke?
Sorry.
Shocking. Okay.
go ahead, take the next paragraph.
Tell you I tell jokes, too.
I mean, I would have been shocked if you didn't.
Electric.
Yeah.
Antoninus had a cave which led from his house to the house of Rebbe. Every time he visited Rebbe, he brought two slaves, one of whom he slew at the door of Rebbe's house, and the other, who had been left behind, was killed at the door of his own house. Said Antoninus to Rebbe, when I call, let none be found with thee. One day he found Reb Hanina ben Chama sitting there, and so he said, did I not tell thee no man should be found with thee at the time when I call? And Rebbe replied, this is not an ordinary human being. Then said Antoninus, let him tell that servant who is sleeping outside the door to rise and come in. Reb Hanina ben Chama therefore went out, but found that the man had been slain. Thought he, how shall I act now? Shall I call and say that the man is dead? But one should not bring a sad report. Shall I leave him and walk away? That would be slighting the king. So he prayed for mercy, and the man was restored to life. He then sent him in. Said Antoninus, I am well aware that the least one among you can bring the dead to life. Still, when I call, let no one be found with thee. Every time he called, he used to attend on Rebbe and wait on him with food and drink. When Rebbe wanted to get on his bed, Antoninus crouched in front of it, saying, get onto your bed by stepping on me. Rebbe, however, said, it's not the proper thing to treat a king so slightingly. Whereupon Antoninus said, would that I serve as a mattress unto thee in the world to come. Once he asked him, shall I enter the world to come? Yes, said Rebbe. But, said Antoninus, it is not written, there will be no remnant to the house of Esav. That, he replied, applies only to those whose evil deeds are like to those of Esav. We have learned likewise, there will be no remnant to the house of Esav. It might have been taken to apply to all.
Well, that's where things got left off. Now, it's kind of weird. Sorry about that. But thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll have better luck next time.